Good afternoon, Lieutenant General Caldwell, Ambassador Herbst, Ambassador Solomon, Assistant Administrator Hess, Ambassador Bishop, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Nate Fryer. I'm a senior fellow with the International Security Program here at CSIS, as well at the same time as a visiting research professor at the U.S. Army War College's Peacekeeping and Stability Operations Institute in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. On behalf of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the United States Combined Arms Center, and the United States Institute of Peace, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to all of you to this event on the release of FM3-07 stability operations. As you all know, today's panel is dedicated to an active discussion of that manual and its implications for U.S.-led and U.S.-enabled stabilization efforts around the world in the future. We're fortunate today to have a distinguished panel of senior practitioners join us. Short biographies outlining their many accomplishments and years of experience are included in your handout, and you're welcome to look at that at your leisure. First, on the far right, is Lieutenant General William Caldwell IV. He's commander of the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Among the many responsibilities of the Combined Arms Center is doctrine development, and it was at Fort Leavenworth that FM-307 was born. Lieutenant General Caldwell has held many command and staff positions, including commanding general of the 82nd Airborne Division, and most recently he was deputy chief of staff for strategic effects at Multinational Force Iraq. Next to General Caldwell is Ambassador Johnny Herbst, the coordinator of the Office for Reconstruction and Stabilization at the U.S. Department of State. He's a career member of the Foreign Service and holds the rank of Minister Counselor. Ambassador Richard H. Solomon, on my immediate right, is president of the United States Institute of Peace, and he has served in that capacity since 1993. Prior to joining USIP, Ambassador Solomon was Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. USIP is both a co-sponsor of this event, but more importantly, a central player in the development of FM3-07. To my immediate left is Assistant Administrator Michael Hess of the United States Agency for International Development. Mr. Hess serves as USAID's Assistant Administrator for the Bureau of Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance. To Mr. Hess's left is Ambassador James Bishop, Vice President of Humanitarian Policy at Interaction, a consortium of 160 American non-governmental organizations engaged in sustainable development, disaster response, and refugee assistance and protection around the world. Finally, batting cleanup is our own Rick Barton at the far end of the table. Rick's a senior advisor here at CSIS and the co-director of CSIS's project on post-conflict reconstruction. Prior to their comments, let me offer some context for this discussion today. Yesterday, as we all know, the United States Army released the third of three groundbreaking pieces of operational-level doctrine in Field Manual 3-07. Preceding the Stability Operations Manual in print were Field Manual 3-24, the Counterinsurgency Manual, and Field Manual 3-0, the Operations Manual. All are seminal accomplishments for the Army and the United States Armed Forces, as all serve to codify the equal prominence of non-traditional defense missions like complex stabilization and counterinsurgency with more conventional offensive and defensive combat operations. Field Manual 307 in particular shatters, I think, the myth that conventional major combat operations alone are the preeminent military mission for the United States, with the implication that all other missions are lesser included endeavors. As we all know, this is not an insignificant change for the American Department of Defense. As we know, the Department of Defense prior to 9/11 and the subsequent irregular wars in Iraq and Afghanistan undervalued the importance of stabilization and defense strategy and planning. Recent history combined with long, hard strategic and operational experience over the last 7 years have been difficult to ignore in this regard. With the new doctrine for stability operations, it's clear that the United States Army and its partners in the wider stabilization and development communities recognize that the core stock and trade of the U.S. military for some time to come will involve serial interventions in complex human-based contingencies around the world. This will occur alongside, in concert with, or in support of interagency, intergovernmental, international, and non-governmental partners. These contingencies will occur in failed, failing, or recovering states under conditions where indigenous order has been seriously undermined or incapacitated by the hostile designs of irresponsible actors, the ruinous confluence of adverse environmental factors, or finally some combination of both. Today it might be reasonably argued that the defeat of internal threats to basic public order and restoration and maintenance of minimum essential political security and economic conditions within victim states together might constitute the new major combat operation for joint land forces. Under U.S. Army leadership, the new Stability Operations Manual represents a important first step in nudging the wider U.S. military establishment toward accepting this notion. In future stabilization contingencies, U.S. military forces and their non-military partners will contend simultaneously with both threats of purpose and context. The former arise from the hostile volition of bad actors, and the latter arise due to adverse conditions in the environment itself. FM3-07 rightly argues that durable success under these circumstances is often enabled by the decisive involvement of military forces on some level. However, it also recognizes that ultimate success against complex social science challenges like this is only possible through comprehensive whole-of-government action leveraging the growing capacity of the wider U.S. government, international community, and private sector. Foremost, the new Stability Operations Doctrine is the product of 7 years of persistent irregular conflict. This experience has resulted in a growing recognition that the most compelling future security threats will likely be unconventional and non-military, and thus by implication require the best combinations of non-military and military capabilities and response. FM 307 is a new roadmap in this regard. CSIS is grateful for the opportunity to host this event today and looks forward to an active discussion by the discussants here in the panel and from your questions in the audience. With that, I'm going to turn the lectern over to Lieutenant General Caldwell for an introduction to the doctrine. We'll have ample time for question and answer after the panel members' formal remarks, so I ask that anyone please hold their questions until the end. General Caldwell.
I'll only stand so that I'm not rude to everybody over on this side of the section here. First of all, let me just say thank you, everybody, for coming today. This is a really historic event for the United States Army, for the United States military, and we're especially grateful that so many of our friends and partners have been working with us over the last year in this effort. Ambassador John Herbst, sir, I just did want to say congratulations on your recent designation as a career minister. Congratulations to you. That speaks volumes about the type of effort and energy the State Department is putting behind in this overall effort. And to Ambassador Jim Bishop, thank you, sir. Ambassador Dick Solomon, Administrator Mike Hess, thank you much to each of you for what your organizations have been willing to work with us in such a collaborative and coordinated manner over this past 10 months and getting to where we are today. And our sincere gratitude goes out to the Center for Strategic International Studies for hosting this event today, and to you, Rick Barton, thank you very much. We appreciate you taking this on and being our host at this event, and to you, Nate, for being willing to moderate it and handle it as we go forward. This is a significant occasion for all of us. It's a culmination of 10 months of intense cooperation between the Army and our close friends and the State Department, the United States Agency for International Development, the United States Institute for Peace and Interaction, as well as many others within the broader interagency community, our allies, and the private sector. Over the course of that time, we've accomplished something really beyond our greatest expectations. Last November, we set out to revise the Army's Stability Operations Doctrine, drawing on the experience of the practitioners in the field, many who are in this room here today with us. But along the way, this effort became a journey unlike any other, and the Army has ever taken in its recent history that we can recall. In crafting a doctrine for the unique challenges that we'll face here in the 21st century, we've blazed a trail into an uncertain future by focusing on three much-needed outcomes. The first is this doctrine is really bridging a great divide in our knowledge base that addresses both today's and tomorrow's challenges. It's a doctrine that answers the call of those already actively engaged in nation building under fire, but it is also a doctrine that looks to the future, where fragile states pose the greatest threat to our national security, a future where regional conflicts threaten to expand into international crises. It is a doctrine founded on the principle that enduring success is achieved by, one, building partner capacity, 2, strengthening the institutions of legitimate governance. 3, establishing and maintaining the rule of law. 4, fostering economic growth. And 5, helping to forge a strong sense of national unity. It is essentially charting a path from violent conflict to stable, lasting peace by providing a roadmap to the future by setting critical waypoints for the conflicts of today. Secondly, it is building the intellectual foundation for leveraging the soft power capabilities in the military that can operate in support of the other instruments of national and international power that are vital to an effective strategy at a very critical time here in our history. This foundation is firmly rooted in the human dimension. So long as conflict is fundamental to human nature, any approach has to begin by addressing the human condition. As we crafted this doctrine, we did so with great respect for the roles and missions of our respective organizations, preserving our proven core competencies while adapting our institutions to the realities of a changing world. This effort is also about achieving true civil-military integration while posturing our government and non-governmental colleagues for success. It is about defining our role in support of broader national and international efforts. And third, it is a driver for change within and outside our Army. In basic terms, this doctrine, this manual on stability operations, is driving a bow wave of unprecedented change. Even before today, it was driving change across the Army as we re-examined our organization, our training, our leader development programs, the very principles upon which our operations are based. But it also drove change in many other agencies and departments. It has been a key educational resource within the State Department's Foreign Service Institute, and is also a crucial reference and the ongoing efforts of the United States Institute for Peace as they develop interagency guidelines for stabilization and reconstruction. Our allies also drew on early drafts of this manual to shape their own approaches, and other organizations continued to reflect on our efforts in their own studies. But what makes this manual truly invaluable is its muddy boots flavor, the hard-won experiences of the practitioners that are out there in the field doing this every day. This manual calls together those experiences into a doctrine built on unity of effort, a comprehensive, collaborative, and cooperative approach that forges a shared vision of a common goal. In closing, this doctrine is a powerful force for change, crafted through a unique community of practice, ensuring the nation is prepared for the challenges of an uncertain future, an era of persistent conflict. With the bravery and commitment of our civil servants and soldiers, will continue to carry the banner of freedom, hope, and opportunity to the people of the world. Thank you, and with that, I'll be glad afterwards to take whatever questions you may have.
General Caldwell, Dick Solomon, Nate, Mike, Jim, Rick, it's a pleasure to be here. This is a great day as General Caldwell introduces the Stability Operations Manual. This is one more and a very important step in the United States addressing the problem, a principal national security problem of our generation, which is the problem of failed states and ungoverned spaces. As General Caldwell said, this challenge requires growing and substantial, I should say substantial and growing, military-civilian cooperation. I'm here representing SCRS at the State Department because we are at the forefront of transformational diplomacy to forge that civilian-military cooperation. We are in the process of creating a civilian surge capacity to deal with the problem of ungoverned spaces. In the State Department budget submitted in February, there is a request for $248.6 million to fund the Civilian Stabilization Initiative that would create a civilian surge capacity, a civilian response corps of 4,250 people who would be available for deployment to crises overseas. This is a surge capacity which would be situated throughout the federal bureaucracy, not just in the State Department. In fact, the principal agency in terms of positions in this would be USAID, although state would also have a substantial number of slots. While we wait for that budget to be addressed by the Congress, I can tell you that the Congress passed in the Afghan-Iraq supplemental, they put an appropriation for $55 million for us to create a civilian response corps of 600 people. There will be 100 people in what we call the active component. These will be people who will be able to deploy to a crisis within 2 or 3 days of a decision, and 500 people in a standby component. Developing this capacity and deploying it is something that will be done in conjunction with our friends in the military, and hopefully instead of, to get to a crisis before it gets out of control, and we can help stabilize a country where we have substantial interest so that our soldiers do not need to deploy. Creating this capacity involves not just the U.S. government. We've been working very closely with the U.S. Institute of Peace. We've been in close contact with NGOs. Jim Bishop I met with several times. Interaction is critical in this. To forge a way forward so that we can draw upon all assets of American society. The Stability Operations Manual is a very important step in this direction. We are trying to bring up the civilian rear to do our share in the joint effort. Thank you very much.
General Caldwell, I just have a feeling that in the launching of U.S. Army field manuals, this may be the largest mixed crowd we've seen in quite a while. And I congratulate you and your troops. You've done a terrific job leading this effort. On behalf of the Institute of Peace, let me just cover a little bit of history and talk about some of our work that's coming up. In 1994, General Tony Zinni gave me a call and said, I've got these war fighters here, but the Clinton administration is sending them off on peacekeeping operations, humanitarian relief activities. Would you help us retrain them for dealing with the kinds of skills and capabilities that are not basic to their training? And thereby launched what is now an ongoing effort at the Institute of Peace to develop training activities and to use our convening power to work with the military, work with the NGO community to develop these new capabilities that are so needed in the world that we're faced with now in the early 21st century. In those efforts, we discovered substantial problems of collaboration. There were very different missions, mission conceptions, different professional identities, conflicting operational procedures that became evident, particularly between the non-governmental humanitarian assistance organizations and the professional military. And over the years, we have tried to bring those communities together. And what we're seeing today is really the result of efforts from these many communities in which we've played a modest but, I think, a significant coordinating role in increasing the kind of collaboration that General Caldwell and John Herbst have now talked about. Unfortunately, in our world, humanitarian crises, the need for post-conflict stabilization and reconstruction activities are all too evident and ongoing in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, 3 years ago, the Institute convened both military and civilian NGO leaders to try to advance this process of developing shared doctrine for stability operations. And I want to express my recognition of the leadership that Dan Serwer, who's our vice president for post-conflict stability operations, and Beth Cole, our colleague who has played such an active role in this effort, they've really, on behalf of the Institute, made very important contributions to this effort. General Caldwell, you've spoken of the need for a, quote, Goldwater-Nichols kind of approach to our shared challenges for the 21st century, or what I like to think of as a kind of purple diplomacy, the need for true interagency operations, interagency training programs, and this gets at the core of our mandate from Congress and is something that the Institute will be doing to try to build on this very important launch today of Field Manual 3-07. We're now working with the U.S. Army's Peacekeeping Institute up at Carlisle Barracks and with the NGOs to develop the civilian side of this military doctrine so that the NGO community, USAID, and others involved on the civilian side will have, if you like, a commensurate and mutually supporting conception, doctrine that will reinforce the guidelines, the conception that is incorporated in this field manual. And I might note that the Institute of Peace is now developing in a much more structured way a professional training center to develop the kinds of courses where, using our convening power, again, we will bring together these communities to draw on the best practices that are emerging from the joint activities that we've been undertaking now for well over a decade. Those of you who may have been down to the corner of 23rd Street and Constitution Avenue may have seen there's a big pit there that out of which is slowly emerging the permanent headquarters of the U.S. Institute of Peace. Right next to that permanent headquarters, there are two extant yellow brick buildings which currently house the Navy's Bureau of Medicine and Surgery. Thanks to Senator John Warner and others in Congress, that BRACT property will, those two buildings will revert to the Institute of Peace, and they will be the location of a professional training effort for which we're now developing pilot courses. So this is an effort that the Institute of Peace is deeply committed to by virtue of our charter from Congress. We're delighted and honored to have worked with you all, both the military and the civilians, in this effort, and we'll be keeping at it. Thank you very much.
I'll break with tradition and just stay right here if you don't mind. It's a long walk back and forth up there. But thanks a lot to CSIS and USIP for hosting this. So on behalf of Administrator Four, my boss, I'd like to thank everybody for inviting us, General Caldwell, John, Dick, Jim, Rick, Nate. Great job. Great turnout, by the way. You throw a heck of a party, Nate. Have to do that. But this is important, and I think it is symbolic. We all talk about the 3Ds. We all talk about interagency. We all talk about whole of government. But I think what you see here for the first time is a manifestation of that. And that's extremely important. The National Security Strategy in 2002 talked about the 3Ds, defense, diplomacy, and development for the first time. But it also recognized what General Caldwell was talking about, and that's the fragile states. Fragile states pose a huge threat to the United States of America and to the peace and security of this world. And Andrew Natsios, my former boss, had a paper published on the Fragile State Strategy for USAID, where we looked at how we try to prevent conflict in those areas of extremism and fragility, where we try to identify those elements where if we apply resources early on, we can prevent a conflict, as opposed to waiting until that time when a conflict comes and then we have to deploy lots more people and expend a lot more forces and effort and money to solve those problems. So the recognition of the Fragile State Strategy by Lieutenant Colonel Steve Leonard and the folks out at the Combined Arms Center in terms of employing that in the construct of this manual is extremely important, and we applaud them. I also want to thank the leadership under General Caldwell and the Army for including the interagency, and not just the interagency, because it's not just about a whole of government. It's the whole of the international community. The fact that Jim Bishop is here representing our partners on the other side is extremely important. And the fact that we were all allowed to participate from the very beginning is critical. Oftentimes in these processes, we didn't include anybody in the drafting of some of our policy statements and things like that until after they're already done. But if you start from the very beginning, include the practitioners in the development of the policy or the doctrine, from the very beginning, there's a higher degree of probability that we'll have some success in that. And so recognizing not just the whole of government, but the international community that's involved in stability operations, I think was one of the keys to success of this manual and getting everybody to buy in. So, General Caldwell, thank you for your open-mindedness in that regard, and that's pretty key for us. Unity of effort. We've had a lot of talk about unity of effort, as you all know from the principles of war. Unity of command is critical. Trying to get unity of command in this room would be a challenge at best. Not that we're not welcome, open to challenges, but it would certainly would be a challenge. But unity of effort is critical. Unity of effort is critical. This is an era of limited resources. If I take, for example, the problems that we have in the current food crisis that's going on around the world, FAO estimates that there are upwards of 869 million people who go to bed hungry every night. The international community can feed about 90 million people, roughly one-tenth of that population. So if you look at it from a resource point of view alone, we could take care of maybe 10% of those people. If you take other challenges, look at the fragile states that exist in the world. You know, if we cannot focus all of our resources, and they may seem to be unlimited, but they are very limited, if we can focus them together, then we have a higher degree of probability of success. And this manual certainly reflects that effort. That working together, we can focus our limited resources to achieve success and impact and an effect that can hopefully bring peace and stability where it may have been a fragile state and going the wrong way. I think this manual goes a long way in terms of recognizing the reality on the ground. Many of us have worked on this for years and years in the field, trying to achieve this unity of effort. We've done it in places like Bosnia, Kosovo, Haiti, all over the world. And we're doing it today in Iraq, Afghanistan, Georgia, Burma, all sorts of places where we have had to work together as a team to achieve unity of effort. I think this is a brave new world that's opening up here with this manual, where we acknowledge that without unity of effort, our probability of success is not as high. And therefore, if we work together, focus our energies and our efforts, that we have a higher degree of probability of success. And so I thank General Caldwell and the team at the Combined Arms Center for including us in the process. You had to put up with a lot of us there for a while, Steve. But Elena certainly led the charge for us at USAID, and we appreciate that effort and being included in the process from the very beginning. So thanks a lot for your open-mindedness. Jim?
Well, let me add my thanks to CSIS and to General Caldwell for the invitation to participate in this event. As indicated, I represent Interaction, the country's leading coalition of American NGOs that engage in economic development and humanitarian assistance abroad. Our members work in every developing country. Interaction and its members engaged in humanitarian relief have longstanding relations with the U.S. Armed Forces. Since the early 90s, we have worked with the military to help its members understand the culture and values of American humanitarian NGOs working abroad. We do this so that the interface hopefully will be positive when we find ourselves engaged alongside each other overseas. We address classes at military schools, participate in conferences hosted by the military, invite them to speak at our meetings, and occasionally role-play ourselves in command post exercises. To give ourselves a multiplier effect in dealing with an establishment that numbers 1.5 million, we produced a DVD explaining ourselves to the military. We assigned liaison officers to Central Command headquarters during the first year of the war in Afghanistan and had a liaison officer stationed with the military in Kuwait City in the months before the onset of the war in Iraq. More recently, we've been closely engaged with AFRICOM as it has defined its mandate, and we're participating with the Chief of Naval Operations in a dialogue about his maritime engagement strategy. With the facilitation of the U.S. Institute of Peace, Interaction negotiated with the Office of the Secretary of Defense and representatives of the Joint Chiefs of Staff the text of a document entitled
guidelines for relations between U.S. Armed Forces and humanitarian NGOs in hostile and potentially hostile environments. Published in 2007, the guidelines bear the logos of the Department of Defense, Interaction, and USIP. This is the background to the request that we received from the Army to assist in the preparation of its stabilization doctrine. Our role has been modest. We have reviewed drafts to help ensure accuracy in those sections which explain to readers what to anticipate in dealing with humanitarian NGOs in stabilization scenarios. Our concern is that the Armed Forces personnel who use this document understand that American humanitarian NGOs must remain independent of the military and free to provide assistance to all non-combatants in need, whether they're sympathetic to the United States or not. NGOs must do this in order to enjoy the access to all innocent civilians anticipated by international humanitarian law. Even if accepting funds from USAID or the State Department, American humanitarian NGOs must be allowed to retain their operational independence. They cannot be expected to be part of a whole-of-government approach or a government-directed unity of effort. They will not be sources of military or political intelligence. In the field, they will expect the military to conform to the guidelines authorized by the Pentagon and Interaction. This means that soldiers will turn up at humanitarian NGO sites only when invited, will meet with them outside the wire, will not refer to them as partners, and will not interfere with NGO relief efforts directed at non-combatants the military may regard as unfriendly. Representatives of a half dozen prominent American NGOs joined me in this process. Some of them are here today. I'd like to take this occasion to thank them for their contributions. We're all grateful to Lieutenant Colonel Leonard for his interest in and respect for our views, and to Lieutenant General Caldwell for encouraging the frank and mutually respectful character of our discussions over the past year. Thanks for your attention. I'll be happy to join others in responding to questions at the appropriate time.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for coming. We apologize for not having more seats. It's great to be overwhelmed by your enthusiasm. It doesn't happen all that often, in particular on some of the inside baseball of Washington policymaking. But thank you all for being here. And thank you especially to the really excellent team that has produced this piece of work, and to you, General Caldwell, for your leadership. I think it's clearly that attitude that has invited others in, and we've heard their appreciation. I thought what I would do is just to serve as a bridge to your questions by maybe putting forward five concerns that I have that I think the panel might be able to address in the course of our conversation, or take a moment before they move to your questions. So what I'd like to do is just offer these five questions as kind of a warm-up and a transition. The first one is, in terms of dealing with this change agenda, what obstacles concern you most? Is it bureaucratic inertia, legacy spending and money shortages that are coming up, a new administration coming in and throwing out the old, the career reward systems that are in place, or just resistance from Capitol Hill? There are plenty of obstacles in this town to good ideas moving forward, but there are probably some that are at the top of your pile, and I think a good discussion of those would be welcome. A second question that I have is, and this is really feeding off of something that General Caldwell mentioned in a piece that's on the Internet. He believes that there's going to be a need for new capabilities and institutions, or there may well be a need, I think is the way he said it. And just in terms of that issue, what is needed on the civilian side, and how does the military not crowd out the rest with its sort of natural strengths? And will our existing institutions be able to take on alien, unpopular, and uncomfortable tasks which we find in every one of these places, such as policing, which tends to be an orphan in many places. A third question really deals with sort of our anticipation, our analysis, our understanding of context. Do we know enough about some of these places that we are now thinking about working in, places like Fatah and Pakistan, to help improve the situation? A fourth question. Have we ever really resolved who is in charge in these places? And does this is there enough clarity, or are the capabilities there to really be able to expand the concept of who's in charge and the unity of effort, the unity of leadership, the unity of command? And how do we deal with this U.S. government asymmetry that we have right now that really does lead us in one direction? And finally, I think the most important question and the toughest question, and probably one that everybody in the room is going to have to play a part in communicating about, is the American public on board. Has the case been made? Can we bring the public along with a vision of respect for the local people, which is really well articulated in this this book? Or is our own interest, will we continue to get on our own way and serve what we think is the greater American interest, and thereby producing the core dilemma that makes us less effective in almost every place we go? So I hope those are fair questions, and I know that we've got the right panel here to take them on, and I look forward to further discussion.
Thank you, Rick, and thanks to all the panelists. I'm going to take a minute to actually just reposition so I can give the panelists a little more room. As you can see, we're fairly crushed here at this table, and it'll allow everybody to spread out a little bit, and then we'll take the first question.
Nate, if you'd like, I can slide off in that way.
No, stay there. I'll pull my chair back.
I'll go to the podium.
I think actually Rick's first question in exercising the prerogative of the chair, I think Rick's first question is actually one that is very appropriate to start with. And so I would actually ask specifically Ambassador Herbst, you may have an insight as to what obstacles you see standing in the way of full sort of socialization of this new thinking inside the U.S. government, in particular on the civilian side.
I think that over the past 6 or 7 years, we've come a long way in trying to establish the notion of jointness and unity of effort. There are certainly cultures in each part of the federal bureaucracy which are not necessarily open to this, but under the press of events and national interests, we've begun to address it. We see it on the ground in Iraq. I mean, yesterday I was at a ceremony where Secretary Rice gave awards to General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker for their great work together. We've seen it in my office as we've developed the Civilian Stabilization Initiative. We've reached agreement in the interagency for something called the Interagency Management System, for a joint effort using all aspects of the U.S. government for addressing stabilization challenges. And we've seen it as we've created the Civilian Response Corps. But while these are substantial steps forward, they're insufficient. There are still cultural differences that have to be broken down. We need to establish joint training. We need to establish incentives in each bureaucracy for people who want to have careers in those bureaucracies to working with their fellow agencies. But we have a path forward right now which will take us to where we want to go. But I agree with General Caldwell, this might be enhanced by the passage of legislation to a Goldwater-Nichols for the civilian side of the U.S. government.
If I can jump on board, what John said is accurate. I mean, we've all been working on this for years, in some cases generations, and I think we've made great progress, and we can't lose the momentum of that progress, I think, is to Rick's point, on a change in administration. There's a lot has happened, and we need to build on that and continue to build on it. And I think items like this manual go a long way to do that. Institutionalizing the IMS, as John spoke about, are critically important to that. And I think the civilian response that we are building is going in the right direction. We at USAID have built into our promotion precepts the importance of an interagency assignment to be promoted. And if you look, go back to Goldwater Nichols, and if you look at that, it was the inclusion of joint service in the promotion criteria that really affected that. And so we recognize the importance of that interagency service as a criteria for promotion and advancement within the agency. And I think that's going to, because the administrator thinks very highly, and the senior leadership of the agency does, about the importance of working across all these boundaries. And I think it's institutionalizing promotion criteria like that that's going to help us a long way in this.
Ambassador Solomon, do you have, or Ambassador Bishop, do you have anything you'd like to add on that particular point on obstacles?
We're very encouraged when we have a Secretary of Defense who's telling the Congress that a part of the solution is to increase the appropriations for USAID and the State Department so that they can develop the capacities which will no longer make it necessary to divert the military from their primary warfighting functions to take on these responsibilities.
I would just pick up on one issue that Rick Martin raised, and that is the question of public support. I think an issue that this country will face as it debates its dealings with the world in the context of highly constrained budgets is going to raise the issue of how many of these kinds of problems can we take on. And I'm unfortunately concerned about the fact that we're looking at one side of the ledger, that is failed states, weak states, humanitarian crises, and failing to see that there are challenges on the other side of the ledger, more traditional concerns about, for example, whether Russia and the question about whether, which I know has been raised in debates by the professional military, about whether we're going so much in the direction of these stability operations that we're weakening our ability to deal with the classical missions of our military, which is to deal with state actors, not just non-state actors, who may present security challenges to our country.
Okay, I'd like to open it up to the audience real quick. And we're going to probably return over time to Rick's five questions, but I'd like to give the audience an opportunity to ask questions. Yes, sir.
I'm Julian Barnes with the LA Times. I'm interested in what the
general thinks, and maybe some of the others, on what the new manual would say about how we should rejigger the current Afghanistan strategy. There's obviously efforts going on in the White House and the Pentagon to look anew at the Afghanistan strategy. And I wondered what the new stability manual, how that would inform those efforts.
Julian, good to have you here. Appreciate that question. Thanks. Just what I was looking for to start off in the blocks there. I'd first start by probably saying that the purpose behind the Army deciding we need to codify and doctrine what we've been doing for many years is the recognition that as we move forward in the 21st century, we're going to continue to operate in this era of persistent conflict. And it's going to require a comprehensive approach if we're ever going to bring from conflict to peace, that the U.S. military alone will never have that capability, and that until we come to full grips with that and learn to operate, as we like to say, in a comprehensive, collaborative, and cooperative manner with all of our partners and our friends, and that's a very clear distinction, and Jim is exactly right when he says, you know, interaction is our friends, and we need to learn how to work with them in a cooperative manner. But all of us collectively together is the only way we're going to define the solutions for the future. There is not a military solution. It is a comprehensive approach that has to be taken. And it's that recognition that is a major step forward. And, you know, we're doing it, everything from working towards putting more of the interagency into our educational programs and our systems to helping develop programs, you know, John Herbst has asked us to help put together different programs to help train and educate members of the Department of State in things from planning processes to actually sending them out, which he has done, to Fort Leavenworth at our Command General Staff College, where they'll spend 10 months immersed in our military educational programs out there, training with our 1,400 students we have each year, those mid-level officers, as they go through training out there, to taking them out to our training centers at the National Training Center and the Joint Readiness Training Center, where you'll find next month we're taking the first real FSI Provincial Reconstruction Team members out and having them engaged and be a part of a mission rehearsal exercise of a unit getting ready to deploy to Iraq, and having them be a part of that training program in the field. So it's no longer just theoretical classroom instruction, but it's now hands-on out in the environment amongst all of the U.S. military, so that we are, in fact, understanding that we will always operate together in the future as one entity. Never again would the U.S. military go alone, because we won't find a solution. Now, that's not really getting right at the question you asked about how it's going to impact on the Afghan strategy. I realize that. But the point is, it actually does, because it's that understanding that the U.S. military can't sit and write a strategy alone, that, in fact, we have to bring in our partners, our friends, and have a dialogue and discussion and look for the involvement of them, because ultimately the U.S. military works in support of the Department of State as we go into some place. And we can't lose sight of the fact that we are a supporting agency. We may have a major overwhelming force there and in numbers and in capabilities, but we don't set national policy. Somebody else does.
Anybody else?
Thanks, Julian. Yes, sir. Right here, sir.
I think I'll take that question for you, representing USAID. You make a very valid point, and one of the first tasks that Administrator Ford took on was rebuilding the agency. And she has begun the Development Leadership Initiative, where we have been hiring more Foreign Service officers into the agency. And for the first time in 12 years, we have hired above attrition. And that's a pretty amazing story. I heard a few. Yeah. First time in 12 years that we've hired above attrition. And so her goal is, and she's worked very closely with OMB and the Congress on this, is to double the size of the Foreign Service in the next 3 years. So that's a pretty ambitious goal. We're well on the way to doing that. The first three classes are already completed. The next one starts in November. So there's a big effort underway to increase the size and the capabilities. As John pointed out, we're building a surge capacity. Our Office of Civilian Response will hire its first 37 people by the end of this year, this calendar year. So we're pretty excited about that as well. So the under the administrator's leadership, we're going to grow the size of the agency and continue to grow it, and most of those people will not work in Washington.
Excuse me, it's Gordon Leubold from the Christian Science Monitor. I'm just curious, the military has been saying, this is probably more for the general than others, but anyone can jump in. The military has been saying that we can't do it alone for all this time. This seems to be laying the foundation for the military doing more, not less. Some would say the military should be getting out of the nation building business anyway. Just wondering if you could get your reaction to that.
And again, this is coming from the senior leadership of our Army, our chief of staff. He, as we have gone through the writing of this manual, he has been engaged with us throughout, literally marking on pages and providing input back to the team, as Steve Leonard served as our lead author here, putting this together. And I can tell you, he has said, if in fact the other elements of the U.S. government, the Department of State, USAID, in fact had the capacity to do what needs to be done, we would not be as engaged as intimately involved in the dialogue and discussion as we are. But in fact, they don't have it, and they won't have it anytime soon, even if they were, in fact, even authorized more people than they're currently being given. It will take time. I mean, you look at Vietnam around the 1970s, early 70s, you know, USAID had about 12,500 USAID personnel operating within Vietnam. Today, I think the entire agency has 1,200. They just don't have the same capacity they used to have. So in the absence of them having that capacity, the U.S. military needs to have the capability to enhance and provide support to them so that they can better execute and do those areas of which they have the expertise and the knowledge that exceeds even ours. But so we are taking the time and effort to build some more organizations, like more civil affairs units. We're adding into our educational instruction base and our training centers a lot more about stability operations than ever before, because we do recognize how important that is going to be if we're going to transition from conflict to peace. We have to have that bridge, and that's what this stability operations does. It provides a bridge to help us get from one to the other. And without that capacity existing in the rest of government, we need to be able to augment and provide support to them.
1 year from today, or a little bit more than 1 year from today, we will have a 600-person civilian response corps ready for deployment. If the Civilian Stabilization Initiative is funded by Congress, 15 months from the moment that occurs, we could have a 4,250-person civilian response corps ready for deployment. That would give us, on the civilian side, the assets we need. But regarding your specific question, the manual would show to soldiers how to behave, how to conduct operations in a stabilization crisis or in an ungoverned space. That would be necessary whether or not there is that civilian capacity.
And I should probably just add, and I try to say that in my opening comment, each of us need to maintain our core capability. And the United States military, specifically the Army's core capability, is to fight and win that land warfare. We cannot lose that core capability. And this does not mean we are going to diminish it or take away from that capability. We have to be able to still do that. But we recognize at the same time there's a balance out there. And when you're conducting military operations, at times you're going to be doing the kinetic piece, the destructive piece, offense and defensive operations. But simultaneously, we need to be able to be doing the balancing of stability operations, the constructive piece. And it's a balance, because at different times you're going to be doing different amounts of them, but you'll always be doing them all the time to some degree.
If I may jump in on that, the military has been doing these operations for generations, as General Caldwell and people have pointed out. This is a manifestation, a realization, and you put the strategy down in writing. I mean, we've been working with the military and USAID for generations. General Caldwell talked about going all the way back to Vietnam. So this is a recognition, and it codifies it for a soldier to have something in front of them on which they can base this. And so some soldiers, I remember when I was a young major, and I was once, a long time ago, I had no idea what USAID was and what they did. Now these folks will have an opportunity to understand what the core competencies are of the rest of the interagency and who to turn to. At least you've got a guideline here, a framework, a roadmap now that sets the road straight and gives them an opportunity to turn to somebody when they're out there in the field.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
My question is for Mr. Bishop. What steps, if any, have been taken to ensure that the firewall between the military and the NGOs is not breached, and are those steps part of the stability manual?
The stability manual incorporates the guidelines, which, as I mentioned, we spent 2 years negotiating with the Office of the Secretary of Defense and the Office of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We're taking those out to the combatant commands to see that there's a broader understanding of them. And when we occasionally find that they're not being observed, we bring those to the attention of the
Department of State, AID, the military, and generally corrective action is taken.
If you think about it, it's to our advantage to maintain that firewall in the United States military, because if it is breached, then they lose their uniqueness and their ability to do what they do so well. And so we don't want it breached. We do want to be able to have some sort of cooperative ability to dialogue with each other, but we very much recognize in no way do we want to compromise or you know, have them lose that integrity and the resiliency that they possess today.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Anna Mulrine with U.S. News and World Report, and I'd just like to talk a little bit about what role democracy plays in all this. I guess the question is directed for the general, but you can all weigh in.
Do you want me to pass it over to Ambassador Herb? She's right beside me. You know, that's a great question, and there was a tremendous amount of dialogue over the last 10 months in that area, as you might imagine. Our ultimate objective with stability operations is to bring greater security and stability to an area, to bring back as much as we can the basic needs for the people so that their base things from water, sewer, electricity, trash, health is food, are to have some minimal standard of rule of law and governance reestablished. That's where we're taking stability operations. Beyond that, it really becomes a national policy decision beyond what the U.S. military is going to engage in.
I'd actually like to throw that question down the table a little bit as well. I mean, from
go right ahead.
From your perspective, from the perspective of the civilian participants, what role do you think democracy promotion plays in the execution of stabilization?
I think it's safe to say that we would prefer to see democracies around the world. And when we engage, we'd prefer to see democracies as the outcome of our engagement. That said, democracy promotion is not easy, and our resources are finite, and the world is full of challenges. So I'd hesitate to offer anything beyond the fact we would prefer to have that as the outcome, not necessarily that we could go in every case to bound and determined to make that happen.
If I can add that, since I am the head of the Bureau for Democracy, obviously we think democracy promotion is pretty important. When you think we're conflicted because we have democracy and conflict in the title, yes, I think we could conflict it. But the importance of democracy, we spend about $1.6 billion a year in terms of democracy promotion around the world. That's a fairly significant amount of money, focusing that effort and trying to bring and reinforce democratic developments, as John was alluding to, are extremely important. But those run the gamut. As Jim knows, a lot of our partners around the world work on things such as anti-corruption, representative forms of government, rule of law. These are all extremely important if we want to try to advance this for give people the say, as General Caldwell said, in the basic fundamentals of their lives so that they have a say and a role in choosing those things and taking care of their families like they want to do. So we think it's very important, and we're going to continue to support that.
As I understand it, depends upon being able to turn authorities over to a government that is going to function in a just fashion and is going to be around for a substantial period of time so that you're not making a round trip. And while democracies are far from perfect, they've got a better track record in doing that than the alternatives.
Yeah, I'd like to add. I think the manual really has quite a few things that are directly democratic ideas. I mean, it has, and I think the tone is actually very well chosen as well, in that it uses the word support as opposed to any other number of choices that we've probably misplaced. But it has supporting judicial reform. It has supporting human rights initiatives. I'm not quite clear on why we've become so skittish about the word democracy or freedom or liberty or whether they've been politicized and whether there have been failures in other places. I think those words still have huge resonance for the American public. And we should find ways to make them sincere and productive as opposed to sort of just mere words. And I think this document does that in a respectful way. So I think it is inherently contained in here, and I have nothing to do with the authorship of this.
Yes, sir.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. Whenever I hear presentations like this, I try to think of a historical precedent, and I haven't heard one mentioned. So if you could choose an example from history of what you were trying to do and say, this is what so-and-so did back then, and this is why it worked, and that is what we're trying to emulate as closely as possible, what would it be?
I'll open that up to the broad collection. Any volunteers?
Having taught history, I'll try and jump on top of that. Obviously, when you look at the post-war, World War II, when we did Reconstruction both in Japan and in Germany, you saw very good examples of it where civil affairs units worked very closely with other branches of the government to re-establish civilian control in those countries. I think those are great examples of where that worked together. And I think the military played a leading role in it, but there were certainly civilian agencies that had a huge role to play in it.
I think regarding the creation of jointness in the U.S. government on the civilian and the civilian military side, we could take what happened with the military in the 1980s of creating joint commands. I would also add, as an historical example outside of our borders, I think the successful efforts by the British in Malaya in the 1950s is partly relevant.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Samira Daniels. This is a question to General Caldwell. You mentioned earlier that one of the central goals is to maintain and a core capability. That's a central goal. Would you say that that is the overarching goal, or is it a corollary of some other goal? And if it is a corollary of some other goal, what goal is it a corollary of?
You want me to answer that?
Yeah.
what I would tell you is the American public expects their military to be able to fight and win their nation's wars. And so we cannot lose that core capability. That's an expectation the American people have of us. And so as we venture forward into looking at what the 21st century is going to look like, I mean, it's an era of real instability. When you look at the impacts of globalization, when you look at the exploding populations, when you look at the demand for what's going to be more scarce resources with greater demands for them, when you look at the fact that you'll see movements of people from probably out in rural areas to urban areas, which are going to put tremendous demands on infrastructure, and all these kind of things can lead to more failing or failed states than perhaps we've seen in the past. So therefore, if we can, in fact, be more upfront and engaged early on, working in support of the Department of State and some of these areas of the world before they become an international crisis, if in fact we believe, and we do in the military, that there are global changes occurring in the climate for whatever reasons, and it's going to cause more natural disasters than we've seen in the past, how are we going to respond to those two? And do, if a host country requests assistance, it's probably the U.S. military that most has that capability to provide that. So we need to lean forward and be prepared and have these dialogues and open up the discussions and educate together and train together so that when called upon to do something, we're better prepared and ready to do it.
I regret briefly, Ambassador Solomon does have to depart, so we're going to take this moment to allow Ambassador Solomon. We thank him. We're very grateful for his participation in the panel. Yes, sir. Right here, sir. Right here.
I'm Bill Lyerly. Bill Lyerly. I'm currently with Homeland Security, but I've spent a whole career working these issues, including with 14 years with USAID. We obviously have to get our house in order before we look elsewhere. And I think this is a tremendous completion of an effort that's been going on, as Mike Hess stated, for decades, if not careers, in getting the United States government ready for this challenge. However, we don't work in a vacuum. The globalization is a tremendous challenge. How do we then work in the next chapter of this manual, if you will, in working with the international organizations, the civilian organizations around the world, as well as region organizations to find local solutions to local problems? Obviously, we have to look at how we're going to do this within the U.S. government structure, but to what extent then can we take it the next the next distance to look at that larger challenge as well?
Ambassador Bishop, perhaps you, I would like to start with you on that. As you talked about clear barriers, and when you're talking about local solutions to local problems, you're actually starting to work very much in your area.
Well, as you read through the document, you'll find that there are numerous references to the authorities of the United Nations and the need for U.S. activities to be coordinated with the United Nations. And that was one of the more fruitful discussions that we had with the drafting team.
And Bill, just to follow on that, you're absolutely right in terms of we've come a long way and we've been working on this a long time. I used to be 6'7" and have brown hair, but I got to work on this a long time. But we've got to think even further than that. When you look at the forces that are at work around the world and just in development alone, think about remittances. In Somalia today, we estimate that $1 billion a year goes into Somalia from remittances. What control do we have over that? We always talk about traditional players in these. There have been estimates that up to two-thirds of the funding that went into the tsunami did not go through traditional donors, went through non-traditional donors. And therefore, the mechanisms, I would submit to you that we as the international community, we as this group, have to start thinking differently. And at AID, we've been thinking differently about that. Or how do you capture these? And I think a lot of it's knowledge management. We have to start thinking in different ways because we are, I don't want to say we're becoming insignificant, but the roles are different. And unless we tap these limited resources and focus them and try to achieve some success, but I can't tell you how to get a handle on remittances in Somalia. I can't get a handle on much of anything in Somalia right now. But, but we're trying, and I think that's a key point, and we've got to start thinking beyond this and even beyond some of those international organizations and get away from these traditional and how do we incorporate those in the non-traditional.
Yes, sir.
General Caldwell, so that this new doctrine just doesn't remain a book on a shelf but gets implemented in reality, I wonder if you could share with us some specifics. For example, how would a lieutenant colonel battalion commander scheduled to go out to Afghanistan or Iraq, or a colonel brigade commander, train differently? What would they stop doing that they did yesterday? What new things would they do tomorrow that they didn't do yesterday? Could you give us some specifics of specific changes that would result from this?
Well, I think the key thing to understand that a lot of the changes have already started occurring over the last couple of years. And so if you were to go today, I was out there 2 weeks ago to our National Training Center, Fort Orange, California. What we do today is nothing like we did 5 years ago, nothing like we did 10 years ago. It's an entirely different environment, conditions, and standards that they have to train against. And, in fact, you're immersed in this stability operations from day one. And while you're going through it through the entire 10 days that you're out in the exercise area and intensely involved in the events like you're deployed already to Iraq or Afghanistan, we put other situations that lead to offensive operations or defensive operations, but the predominant element that we are working on and with during that 10 days is stability operations. So when I was out there the other day, although a convoy I was on got attacked by an RPG-7 with an IED and some other things, and we had to react to all that, during that day-long period that I was out there with that one element, you know, we were doing negotiations with local sheikhs. We were engaging with the people. We were working some water situations. We were dealing with an epidemic that had broken out in another province with a health issue and figuring out how to get the world health folks involved. The NGOs are all out there. The role players that we have right now playing Department of State were all out there so that you're having to deal with all these different entities and organizations to work towards some sort of collective solution to how to handle that, because the military, in fact, does not have the full capabilities to take care of each of these situations they're presented with. So we're putting them through the intellectual process now. Conversely, in the, you know, one of the things I have responsibility for within Training and Doctrine Command is education for our Army. And so within our schoolhouses, now with the doctrinal manual having officially announced yesterday, you'll see that as a part of our instructional processes. So when you go through the education part of it, it will be embedded into our discussions and our exercises that we run in the educational system. So we'll do it in the education and in the training aspects of the Army. But mostly in the training part, we're already doing it. And, you know, anybody that would want to come see it, we'd love to take and show anybody who would have a desire and interest to spend a day out there, you know, and host anybody really that would like to see how we do it, because we think it's important to show that and share it with others. I mean, we've actually made the differences of 5 years ago is amazing. You wouldn't recognize our training centers today from 5 years ago. And that's how much different it is.
But yes, sir.
I guess what's key, and I'm sorry, is this doctrine now codifies it in writing and makes it a part of who we are. That's something we have not done well in the past. We were pretty good at this, too, at the end of the Vietnam War. But we didn't codify it in doctrine. And we sure didn't make it a sustaining capability within the armed forces, especially in the Army.
Yes, sir, we have a question over here.
Mark Hugus, Time Magazine, question for General Caldwell. Building on that thought, what do you think will be the biggest visible changes to operations for troops in Afghanistan and Iraq to reflect these ideas in the near term?
But I would tell you in the near term, one of the things we're trying to do is to ensure that within the educational systems, that when you turn around and look at a classroom of 16 students, which is how we do our training and educating of our officers in small group seminars, that the makeup, we spend a lot of time to work in the collective makeup of those 16 people. And what we want to eventually have is a person from the comprehensive approach, the whole of government, in each of these 16 people groups, because today we do not have that. In fact, when I arrived at Fort Leavenworth last year, we had only two people out of the 1,250 out there that were from the interagency. We were able to get it up this past year to 14. We would hope to at least double that by next summer, too, and then hopefully double that again the following year, as people understand that we want to bring on and have them be a part of our educational system. You know, We've told all the departments and agencies of the U.S. government, if you will send somebody to school, they can come for free. We don't want you to pay for it. Just pay for their salaries and take care of the people and send them out there, and we'll give them a 10-month free education with a master's degree in military arts and science and immerse them inside of the United States military and our international partners. As you know, we have over 100 international students that are part of our curriculum there, too. You know, that has been a great success story. And let them spend the year teaching us about their culture and about their organizations and about how they approach problems, and then conversely we'll share the same thing. Next month, like I said, we'll have them out at National Training Center. For the first time, we'll actually take a Department of State Provincial Reconstruction Team class and take them out and have them be a part of a rotational rehearsal exercise of a unit getting ready to go to Iraq and Afghanistan. So we actually dialogue and talk and interface with those who normally we don't meet till we arrive in theater. And the first time you meet them is on the ground in Iraq or Afghanistan, and you spend the first month or two really understanding each other's cultures and requirements and everything else. So that is a major shift that we're continuing to work towards. And fortunately, we've got some at this table here are two gentlemen that have been absolutely wonderful about it. Mike and John have fully embraced it and have been great supporters of assisting us with that effort. We just need to get the rest of the U.S. government engaged to doing that.
Could I just jump in on that? I think in a couple of these questions, there's, I think, the expectation on the part of the American public that we're going to be able to turbocharge this a little bit and improve our likelihood of success, at least in Afghanistan, and that with these hundreds of thousands of soldiers who now have had the personal experience, actually, in one of these conflict cases, and with the hundreds of and really thousands of civilians that have also had direct exposure, how do we seize on those kind of natural assets and those veterans of these experiences and put them into play so that these next troop surges that we're going to see in Afghanistan have that added element of the manual and of the more formal training you're describing. I think how we put those two things together is really going to be probably how we're judged over the next year and a half, even as this more deliberate process takes hold and is formalized. And I think, I mean, again, any comments that the panelists might have to that purpose, I think that's the expectation. I don't think it's an impatience, because I think there's a recognition that there are a lot of lessons that have been learned and that many of the things you say in here have really been, if they're not institutionalized, at least they've been personalized. But I think that's the point of tension still.
I guess what I would say is we already are taking a lot of these lessons learned. You know, of our 800 Army officers out of our school at 1,200, almost 1,400 now out of Fort Leavenworth, you know, 85% of them are combat veterans. 37% of them have been deployed at least twice. 18% have had over 3 years in theater. My command sergeant major just came back. He's got 42 months cumulative time in Iraq. I mean, these are experienced officers that understand and appreciate how critical this skill set is, this stability operations, and the importance of what it can bring to the challenges that we face both in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they very much embrace it, and they support it. We put this manual together, one, to guide today, but as much to help us through the next 25 years, because we are in an era of persistent conflict, as our chief of staff says, and that there will be tremendous instability in the years ahead. And our nation needs to have the capabilities to be prepared for that. But what's going to be important is we can only do this as a comprehensive approach. And if, in fact, we don't provide the incentives and the other elements of the U.S. government so that there is a true desire to be a part of this effort, then we in the military can spend all the time we want preparing our officers and our non-commissioned officers and our soldiers, but it will be insufficient. It will not be enough unless the entire U.S. government, or as we like to say, really a comprehensive approach, because it's far more than just the U.S. government, doesn't get engaged. And today, as Mike Hess talks, there are incentives within USAID that they're starting to put into place. It needs to be that way across the entire U.S. government. When we ask them to come train with us out at our school, we have a pool of officers we're ready to pull from and give them an officer replacement, one for one, so that they can, in fact, free up somebody from Department of Treasury to spend a year with the U.S. military training and educating, and we'll put an officer in that seat. Now, they're not going to be as qualified in all the aspects, but they're going to be dedicated, committed, willing to engage, smart, combat deployer, Today, there's two or three of them in the room that we're doing that with already this year. I've seen them in the audience here. And they're out in places like USAID. They're working for John in his office. But this is a select group of gentlemen. Unfortunately, we don't have enough yet across the entire U.S. government, and we need more people engaged and understand how critical this is for our nation. And we have to take it on and embrace it and support it across the board.
But I'd also like to add that this process is very much underway. Mike and I both sit on a senior interagency board overseeing training for operations, including in Iraq and Afghanistan. My folks are down, and Mike's folks are down at Fort Bragg training folks for the PRTs. So this is ongoing, but Bill's right. This has to – we need to broaden it. Yeah. But it's going. It's happening.
And I think we have to get better used to using technology to get these lessons. We used to call them lessons unlearned. And we need to populate that better so it's more real-time. We need to take advantage of the technologies that are out there, and the administrator is pushing forward on the Global Development Commons to share these ideas across the board, because it's not just about what we do. It's what we do on our side, too. I mean, I travel around places, and you see, why aren't we using water catchment programs that we use in the Sahel in southern Madagascar? You know, when we have the same partners doing the same things, it drives you to distraction. And we've got to get better at this because we don't have the time and resources to waste on these things. And so you're right. The knowledge management piece of this, and we've been talking a lot with Leavenworth on this, and the Elena's working with PKSOI. How do we capture this and make it real time? And I think in this day and age, shame on us if we can't do that better.
Sir, I'm going to get to you in a moment. I want to expand on that question for 1 second and ask to the civilian participants, what do you anticipate? I mean, given all the what seems to be great sort of emphasis inside the Department of Defense to begin to sort of build capacity outside of the Department of Defense and reallocate and redistribute resources accordingly, what do you think the prospects are that you'll see a real reallocation of responsibilities and resources in the next 5 to 10 years?
I'll go first. We've already seen some changes in that. Fortunately, as I talked about the DLI, Development Leadership Initiative that Administrator Ford put forward, it's been very well received on the Hill. And we're already seeing in the supplemental, both the 08 and the bridge, some increased resources on and some recognition of the effort that she's put into it. And part of that is because we demonstrate what the U.S. government and what the American people will get out of those, double the number of foreign service officers. What do you get out of that? What is the U.S. government going to be able to achieve? And we've been able to demonstrate those effects. And so I think you're starting to see that now, and it's a very positive move. Our friends at Interaction have been very supportive, and our friends at DOD as well, as I think Jim mentioned that Secretary Gates has been very vocal in asking for the Congress and the administration to increase the budgets for AID. And I think you're seeing that already, and certainly it's happened at the State Department as well. So I'm very encouraged by those directions.
A little different lesson and perhaps a little bit out of character. I think we're going to get involved in foreign wars. We should use sufficient force to seize, hold, and deliver, and not let the tide turn against us. The long war is not inevitable. In Afghanistan, we urged in 2002 that ISAF be expanded beyond Bagram and Kabul to provide sufficient ambient security throughout the country so that NGOs and foreign agencies could begin to deliver to the Afghan people. And a decision was made not to do that and to use our forces elsewhere, and we're all paying the price today.
Sir, you've been quite patient. We have a microphone coming here, sir.
Yes, I'm John Young from the Millennium Project. I have two points. One is a follow-up to a previous answer. Doesn't it seem as if we're going to have, and I think there have been efforts along this line, aren't we going to have greatly expanded peace games in which all of the players will, in fact, be people from the corresponding organizations, not military people playing those roles, because those organizations have to learn how to work with the military as well as going in the opposite direction. And another point, I've heard mention of the concept of a human terrain, and I wondered if someone could comment on whether that idea might have some implications in the in the conduct of stability operations?
I think the point on exercising would be is one that probably should be fielded by the civilian discussants, because I think that is an area of growth that we need to make sure we build on. And then we'll go to the human terrain question next.
As we've been building the concept and now building the reality of a civilian response corps, we've been training within our resources actively with the military. We've been training with Joint Forces Command, with SOUTHCOM. We're going to be training with EUCOM. This is something which is ongoing. It's only going to get bigger. And the concept we've developed for an active component of the civilian response corps, which would be people whose only job it is to deploy to places in crisis, they will be training literally for many weeks and even months with the military as we get them ready.
You actually have
people. The gaming picture?
When you're doing a peace game, have people from the actual, from the NGOs, from other military forces, from other governments, have the same mixture in the game that would actually apply if the situation were real, not just have all military people playing the parts of other actors.
I think that's a very key point. If you want to talk about the gaming piece I think you're talking about subject matter experts that are resident. I mean, General Caldwell has talked about the fact that we're going to have this FSI class that's going to go out to the National Training Center and participate in this. But we've been working very closely with the Army staff and looking at the CTCs, their combat training centers, on how they pick role players and subject matter experts for that, and so that we have a larger. But the issue is larger than that. The military does more exercises in a week than we do in a year. I mean, so what we've got to do is work with the military, and we are right now, the leadership group that John referred to earlier, where we target appropriate exercises. Where can we get the most out of the limited resources that we have available to contribute to an exercise? Not only that, but you've got to get in the scenario writing so that it's an appropriate role for those civilians to play in that exercise. And that's a long-term process, and we are working with Joint Forces Command, as John mentioned, and with the Combined Arms Center out of Leavenworth, to identify those critical exercises where we, the civilian component, can add value. I remember when a friend of mine who was at Save the Children said, I could do one exercise a year, one a year. So pick it and make it a good one. And that's what we're up against. We don't have the people to staff all these exercises. One of the priorities that we've established, and the Office of Military Affairs has been established at AID for that particular reason, so that we have a focal point so that the military can come in and say, hey, we've got these priorities. The priority for us right now is units that are getting ready to deploy to combat. Those are the priority exercises for us. Those train-ups are key for us, and that's where we apply our resources. And so we keep the focus with the military on identifying those exercises so they can get the most out of it, and we can as well.
We prioritize our limited resources in much the same way. It's primarily in a classroom environment because for the reasons that Mike just explained, the pre-planning phase, the planning phase, the actualization phase are enormously time-consuming. Save the Children doesn't have a float. CARE doesn't have a float. World Vision doesn't have a float. They can't provide folks who are going to be available for a month to walk you through all those phases. So we send folks out to meet with units that are about to deploy to share with them our thoughts about civil-military relations. We sometimes go out into the field. We were out in Nairobi a couple of months ago with JCTF HOA, giving them some feedback from NGOs in the region about some of the problems that they were inadvertently causing via some of their activities. But it's a very constrained resource environment for NGOs.
I think it probably invites the question of change for these other institutions as well, though, to not have the float. I had a chance to run an office in AID, and we basically said, look, we're going to dedicate at least 2 weeks a year to your critical skill improvement, to your personal critical skill improvement. If we don't do that, we're failing you. I don't see that kind of commitment across the civilian agencies. It's really unusual. I don't see it in the NGOs. It's really been one of, there have been serious constraints. But again, if you're committed to doing the job really well, you're going to have to change the way you do it. Otherwise, you're accepting mediocrity as the way you're going to approach things. And so for this kind of initiative to work, it's going to take the military taking on some practices that it's not familiar with and moving, which this is suggesting. And the civilian side is going to have to be equally aggressive. And I think that that may be that we hide behind the argument of weakness and shortness of resources as an excuse in some cases for not doing that.
Yeah, yes, sir. You've been very patient. Thank you.
Leonard Oberlander, a consultant with some historical background in this field. Given the emphasis somewhat on knowledge, not there, and the multiple partners, there are knowledge providers, knowledge managers, and knowledge utilizers. And given the other multiple roles of the partners, I wonder if you could give a characterization, if not a definitive answer, something to grasp of how is the relative share or experience of leadership and partnership handled in the unity of efforts during the phases of this effort in identifying needs, in resource planning and allocation, and then finally in project and program actions. What is the relative weight of leadership? How is it handled? How would you characterize it?
That's a somewhat abstract question. And I think the way it would be approached would depend upon the circumstance. But I can give you a specific answer based upon the work that my office has done in cooperation with the rest of the interagency. I mentioned we've created something called the Interagency Management System. This system would be used when we have a quote-unquote stability or stabilization crisis. When you have such a crisis, you'd form an interagency group, which would include a secretariat that would have the job of providing an analysis of the situation. It would devise a plan of overall civilian operations. The military would be sitting there, as would the civilians from OSD, to help make sure that there's a military component to operations that is linked fully with civilian planning. But ultimately, a decision taken in a crisis will be taken at the highest levels of our government, and they would determine who's in charge.
Patient. Yes, sir, you right here. Yes, sir.
Walter Pincus, The Washington Post. I wonder if we'd be talking about this at all if we hadn't gone into Iraq, which was not a failing state. And essentially, this is built upon that. But if you read through it, it's built on the assumption that we're going to take over a government. General Caldwell, you talked a little bit before about governments inviting us in. But as you read through the plan, we're going to remake their police, remake their judiciary, remake almost every part of their government, including elections and the rest of it. This idea that we're going to have serial interventions into failed states. You've mentioned a couple of failed states already, Somalia, Darfur, Sudan, the Fatah area. I assume you're not planning to go into all of them. And I assume, of course, you're going to say it's a presidential decision. But aren't you leaving the impression that as we look down the road, we're not just going to fight traditional wars, we're going to take over governments and remake them, sort of in our image? And are we capable of doing that?
Well, first of all, Walter, I'd say we probably should go back through the book together just because that's not at all the intent. Let me just share, if I could, two experiences. In 1988-89 time frame, I was serving as a planner in the 82nd Airborne Division. And we wrote the invasion plan for to go down and execute Operation Just Cause in Panama. And I went down and executed it with the 82nd Airborne Division. And I still remember very vividly about the third day into the operation when my boss turned to me and he said, okay, Bill, as the 82nd Airborne Division's lead planner, how are we going to stand back up the police now and get the trash picked back up on the streets? And I recall looking at him saying, sir, that's not our job. We don't do that kind of thing. Somebody else handles this phase four stuff of reconstruction. I mean, one of my junior planners who were with me looked at me and goes, sir, I don't even know what reconstruction is. You know, I mean, because that's not what the military did. We fight and win wars. We come in with overwhelming force. We had an incredibly great plan that we had put together. We took down the government very rapidly. We did it with minimal loss of life, and yet we had no follow-on, coherent, organized plan as to how then we're going to pass it back to the people of Panama so that they could take control of their own destiny very rapidly. Fast forward a couple years, I'm in Haiti, and deja vu all over again. You know, here we are, and I've got the American ambassador, Bill Swing, turning to me saying, okay, Bill, as I'm working with him there in the American embassy, how are we going to go about paying these police? Right now we've literally carrying bags of money around, and we're running around the country doing this hopscotch thing, and we don't have a coordinated plan on how we're going to rehabilitate and stand back up some of the waterworks. And I remember we went through it all over again. We had devised an incredibly great invasion plan. We knew exactly how to go in and take down the country, but we had not worked through the follow-on piece. You can fast forward it to wherever you want after that. This is a recognition that from the day one, before you ever think about if you are going to intervene into some place, you have to start talking and working and planning for stability operations. And it's done throughout the entire thing. There is no thing called phase four, which is the first time we start thinking about that. It has to be done from the very beginning. It's done at different levels and degrees, but we have to be with our partners and our friends from the very beginning, having some sort of dialogue and discussion about it too. Because ultimately, we're all going to be there together if it's an intervention when the intervention is over. We've got an incredible military force. There, you know, you'd be challenged to find somebody that could defeat us militarily. But we're not going to win the peace with that force, not alone. And that's why it requires this comprehensive approach. We would hope that there are situations in the future where there never is a requirement to do anything but go provide some humanitarian aid in support of whatever the Department of State wants to do and some other situations like that. And that's part of the stability operations effort.
Yes, sir. Oh, the point is this. There are literally dozens of failed or failing states. Not all of them require America to get involved. There may be occasions, though, where we have critical national interests and we will have to engage. When we choose to engage, and we have to be prudent when we choose to engage, we need to have the capacity to deal with the problems. Ideally, we will get to these countries before they completely fall apart, so we don't need to put the military in. But we have to have the ability to help stabilize. That is not a blank check to engage all over the world, though.
Okay, we actually have time for we're going to bunch three last questions. And I think Tammy, this gentleman right here, and then you, sir, right there. If you could all actually ask your questions, we'll take all three questions for a final response. So,
hi, Tammy Schultz, U.S. Marine Corps War College. Just to bring it back to Rick's fifth question about the American people, I applaud the Army's efforts. I think that you do have to fill that short-term capacity and capability gap. But my question is how to do so without sort of creating the moral hazard that civilian capacity won't be created. I mean, the only reason, thanks to Ambassador Herp's great efforts and those of your office, you kept SCRS on the ropes, but, you know, not the knockout punch being landed. And there's going to be increasing budgetary pressures. You've got entitlement spending going up. You've got increasing fiscal pressures based on the financial crisis, reset and modernization of the military. It's going to get better before it gets worse. So how do you make the case to the American people?
Okay, yes, sir, back in the corner. Right here.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter Koharis. I'm my own international law and consulting firm. From our discussion, I understand there are three basic doctrinal changes. I wonder if this understanding is correct and whether you could add to this. One, General, your last comment that we will, as part of any major use of force, we will have as part of the mission structure a transition phase that will be a part of, not simply we'll topple the government and then we'll pull out our troops and then we'll get the UN involved, that this will be a core part of U.S. mission. Second, that whether Geneva requires it or not, whether we call ourselves an occupying force or not, that we will ensure security on the ground, as I think the JAG Corps argued in Iraq, but the civilian leadership overturned. And third, based upon Ambassador Bishop's question, that we will have a certain force-to-civilian ratio. These all sound like major doctrinal changes in terms of how the military deploys force. Is that correct in this doctrine, and are there any other major ones that you'd like to highlight for us before we end today?
And then where was my final question? It was over here somewhere. Yes, sir.
Gene Dewey, formerly with some experience in Afghanistan and Iraq at the State Department. What I've heard today is a paraphrase of Secretary General of the UN, Boutros Ghali, who said that, the paraphrase would say, that stability operations are not an army mission, but only the army can do it. And what I've heard today, and what I've heard about the prospects and the promise of 3-07, doesn't really seem to change the potential for that changing in the next decade or so. And this is disappointing. I had hoped that it would take us farther than that. In terms of historical examples that might have helped influence the field manual, rather than looking at the field manual to influence Afghanistan, I would point to Afghanistan. The first 2 years of Afghanistan, which were arguably very successful in stability operations. Why were they successful? Because Colin Powell made the United Nations agencies and a good UN team, UNAMA, as the center of gravity for and as the engine for stability in Afghanistan. I don't see in what we've heard today much reference to that 2-year success story. I haven't heard much reference to the UN at all. They seem to be the skunk at the picnic at this this particular discussion. And that's disappointing. It seems as if you had done a thorough job of looking at all the tools of statecraft, and looking at the total force, which is what we have to look at, is to look at cases where the UN has worked, and I can cite several more than Afghanistan in those first 2 years. Would appreciate any comments on that. Thank you.
Sir?
I'll start off by just saying FN-307, we in fact had a tremendous amount of dialogue with the United Nations. In fact, I was up there personally engaging myself even through parts of this, as were the whole team, much more than even I, because it is critical that we were having that discussion. We passed off earlier drafts. We took information back from them. And again, more in terms of looking at them as our friends, because, you know, they're not going to, per se, sign up for a U.S. Army doctrinal manual, but they gave us some absolutely invaluable input and thoughts and ideas as we went through this process, because we do recognize and very much appreciate how important it will be to look at that aspect in the future. So from Ambassador Khalilzad all the way down, we had discussions not just on the American side but on the peacekeeping side and other offices within the UN as we went through this over the last 10 months. And they've, in fact, even come out to Fort Leavenworth and spent time with us from the UN out of Fort Leavenworth having discussions with us on this. So there's been a pretty robust engagement with them through this process, as there has been lots of other folks, though, too. But we did recognize how critical they are as we went through it. In terms of the major changes that you're going to see in the manual, there's no question that what we mentally, there is a mindset we're bringing about by this doctrinal manual. It will be a cultural shift in our Army that, in fact, we up front must provide and put assets and people and time against talking about the entire comprehensive approach to how we're going to conduct stability operations. We've not always done that. We didn't do it. I can tell you from my level in Panama, and we really didn't do it in Haiti, which I can only cite because of personal experiences. But I can tell you that there's now that recognition. This is from what we're doing is being done because, excuse me, General Casey has put this focus and effort in here, and he's putting the, you know, our time and energy against it because he knows how important this is that we get this right. But there is a mindset that has to change in our Army, that we have to spend time in that area. That, in fact, what we have traditionally done is just plan the combat operations, the destructive piece, and haven't spent time on the constructive piece. And we have to do that. There's a balance in there, and it needs greater attention than we've given it in the past. And we're doing that today, but we've codified it in this manual to ensure that we continue to do it into the future. As far as security goes, you are correct. There is a requirement, and it's clearly recognized, and we discussed that in there, that in order to set the conditions so other things can succeed, so that the NGOs and can, in fact, operate with much greater freedom, independent of us, but in the area, because we are, in fact, providing greater security, is very important. And that would be part of that overall discussion and dialogue that we would want to see taking place up front. In fact, when you go to our training centers, you'll see that kind of interaction go on now and that dialogue take place between the military and other elements outside of the U.S. Armed Forces. So I just pass off those two. And as far as making the case to the American people, you know, I would tell you the Secretary of Defense has been very upfront and vocal about how important it is that the State Department, USAID, and other elements of our U.S. government be given the capabilities, the resources, people, and money so that they can build up these capabilities because they're important for our nation so that we can, in fact, operate in a comprehensive approach. Those are not fully funded nor resourced today, and they need to be. I mean, I've even heard the Secretary of Defense go so far as to say in many cases he had much rather have, you know, additional X number of people from the interagency than he would one more combat battalion. And, you know, if you talk to the folks on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan today, they'll tell you just how critical that embedded PRT or the PRT is that operates in their area, that it is, in fact, an incredibly combat multiplier that they would much rather have than another battalion of infantry on the ground. You'll hear them talk about the human terrain teams and the cultural anthropologist and how much they bring to the understanding of the people in the area and where we're operating and the sensitivities that we need to be aware of. I mean, these kind of assets are just great capabilities that aren't resident within the U.S. military, nor do we need to make them resident within the U.S. military, but we need to have them there with us on wherever we go in the future so that we can operate together because they do greatly enhance our overall capabilities.
Sir?
Well, I have a few points to address at least two of the three questions / comments. One, regarding the notion that there's been no change to address this challenge. I frankly disagree. The change has been slow in coming, but it's real. A year from now, we will have a small but potent civilian response corps to address the problem of stabilization overseas. If the Congress funds this the Civilian Stabilization Initiative, two plus years from now, we'll have a substantial, potent instrument to address this problem. Regarding American people's support, the point is really very simple. We need this capability, as General Caldwell outlined. If we develop it and we use it, we will save lives and we will save money. It will be a cost and a life saver, and that's a case we can make effectively to the American public. Finally, regarding the UN, we have reached out to the UN and around the world to build civilian capability to deal with the problem of stabilization operations. We are in regular touch with both UNDP and the UN Peacebuilding Support Office, and also the UN Peacebuilding Commission, to promote capability. Thank you.
Just a couple of points. Your point on public awareness is key, and that's why we're here today, is to try and improve that. Otherwise, we wouldn't all be sitting up here. But not facetiously. I mean, this is important. And I think the effort that the Army has made to make this an inclusive process for the interagency and the whole of government is a first step. It's a process. And I think it speaks loudly to the leadership, both of the Army and the civilian agencies that have participated, that you're starting to see that. And I think the fact that the Secretary of Defense has gone out publicly and stated that he welcomes support for the rest of the interagency, specifically state and IAD, is a huge step forward, and we applaud that. But you're absolutely correct. one of the problems that I found when I arrived at USAID is that we think that our good works speak for themselves. And that's wrong. We have to tell our story. We have to do a better job of telling our story, and we don't do a good job of that. We have to be able to look at our constituencies and say, what are we doing with the money that you entrust to us, and how are we putting that to good work, and what are the results and the effects we're getting out of it? A lot of good things happen around the world. The U.S. Agency for International Development keeps 3.1 million people alive in Darfur. I would challenge you that if you walk out on the street today, that you won't find very many people who know that. That's wrong. I mean, it's a great testament. We will send 1 million tons of food to the Horn of Africa this year. 1 million tons to keep people alive in the Horn of Africa. I would bet you a meal anywhere in town that unless you're listening to this, you go out there on the street tonight and ask somebody that, nobody will know. Now, we do that through our good partners, World Food Program, a lot of the NGOs, our friends at Interaction. Now, we don't do it by ourselves, but the American people are very generous, and we don't tell that story. And we do it very effectively, considering the small percentage of the budget that we have to operate with. And so you're absolutely correct. We need to do a better job of that, and we're working on that. And we have to continue to work on that. And we're going to continue to push that. On security, you're absolutely right on the transition phase. We haven't talked too much about security sector reform, but it's a whole section in this manual. And it's critical because without security, there's nothing. You won't have economic development. If you don't have rule of law, if you don't think about the basic fundamental principles of what it costs to doing business in a country, it starts with security. You talk about people who were going home in Bosnia. They wouldn't go home until they realized that their neighborhoods were safe. You can't send your children to school unless the children can be safe getting to school. The basic principle revolves around security. And security sector reform is very critical, and winding its way through the government process right now is one of the first security sector interagency policies. It's about completed. It's about signed. I hope I don't jinx it. Now, somebody will veto that policy, and it won't get done. But it's good. It's a first step forward. Recognize, because this is hard stuff. It is very complex, and it's not just a military job. We work very closely with the UN, UN CIVPOL. These agencies work very hard to try and institute security around the world, and it's critical to the success. And you can see examples of it, for example, in Liberia, where finally we're getting some security in there. That's a step in the right direction. In terms of working with the UN, obviously, Gene, we work very closely with them all over the world. We encourage their leadership, and we look for their leadership in certain areas where we think it's absolutely crucial. We work very closely with World Food Program in our area, UN OCHA and others, to make sure that we have a multilateral approach to this, and they are critical to the success for other peoples around the world. So it's a very key point. But this manual is critical to bringing all those elements together. And it's more, I think, the process. The fact that the military has welcomed the rest of the interagency and the civilian communities and the UN, they're part of the civilian communities, into this process is a great step forward. And it's the leadership that makes that happen. So I thank them for this effort and the opportunity to be here.
My suggestion would be, in trying to sell this to the American public, that it be advertised not as the definitive answer, but as a transition strategy, a transition to the period when we have more adequate military force levels, when we have a civilian capacity which will relieve the military of the burden of performing some of the tasks that are assigned to it in the doctrine, and that we're positioned internationally in a manner which will allow us to elicit a much greater degree of burden sharing than we can at the moment. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for being here. And I would just say that in terms of how far we've moved, I was at a meeting yesterday of 25 practitioners, and they said if something like this manual had been produced 10 years ago, the president would have been impeached. So the public... The public appetite apparently has changed, or at least the risk profile of administrations. I do think that in terms of a couple of the questions, the U.S. public, I think the U.S. public still wants to see the wisdom of the cases that we commit to and the realism of the ambitions that we describe that we're going into a place with. And they probably want to see us grounded in a lot of the pragmatism that's in the manual, but also want to make sure the policy is equally grounded. Where are our friends in this case? Do we have any partnerships? What is our level of commitment, and what's the ripeness of the place? I mean, these are really fundamental questions that if you start off in the wrong place, it's awfully hard to have this manual make it work, no matter how much commitment. I think our commitment has been genuine over the last 10 years, whereas perhaps in the 90s we thought we could get in and out and do it on the cheap. I don't think that has been the model of this last several year period. I think on the United Nations, it's pretty hard to claim that we do not continue to be disdainful of the UN. I think our national respect still needs to be elevated if we're going to in fact have the fully healthy relationship that is needed to make the burden sharing that you always champion, Gene, as fruitful as it might be. And I think it might even come to joint missions. I mean, there's something like 12 U.S. military personnel in the 100,000 or so UN peacekeepers around the world. That would be a sign of American sincerity, that we actually believe that a UN mission is going to work. We're paying for it, and there's always something to be said for that. But I think the full commitment of our it can be measured in other ways. And until that happens, then it's not going to be as real a relationship as we probably need. And I think the other points that I'd make have already been made. So thanks, Nate, and thank you all for being here at CSIS today.
Well, that concludes the official program. I thank you all on behalf of CSIS and the Combined Arms Center, as well as the United States Institute for Peace, for attending today. I think it was a very successful event. We look forward to the future sort of promulgation of the doctrine as it goes forward throughout the joint and international interagency community. Thank you very much, sir.